Several years ago, I was sitting at the desk in the chaplain's office at the Denver Women's Prison, waiting for one of the inmates, and I could hear my own breathing. It was heavy and quick, not at all what I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be calm and centered and cool, but it was no use. It was my first pastoral care appointment, first ever. So I was very nervous. She arrived shy and slow. She showed me her ID and her pass, told me her number quickly, formally. She sat down across from me and called me Pastor. And then it was quiet. We both breathed, and I knew I wasn't the only one trying to be braver than I felt. "Did you have something you'd like to ask me?" I began. "How can I help?" Finally, she offered, "I've been having some struggles with the devil. Actually, I'm angry at God." She backpedaled quickly. "I know that's a sin. I can't be angry at God. I'm just angry at myself. I've been fighting myself." And then she held out her arms, covered in scars, lines running horizontally up and down the veins. When providing pastoral care, you always want to ask yourself these questions: why me, why here, and why now? I mean, we all show up with our own stories and questions and fears and struggles, and part of the power of pastoral care lies in the mysterious ways our stories come together in a given moment in service of a new healing and new hope. As I sat there that afternoon with this beautiful, wounded woman, I couldn't help but shake my head at the mystery of being handed her request. This random request of all requests that are made to the chaplain's office every day, to be handed this one, for this one to be my very first. There were other reasons, but the one I always return to whenever I think about our conversation was God. With all her scars and her anger and her fear, she was stuck on God. Stuck on a God that couldn't handle her for who she was, couldn't take her anger, her pain, or her truest self. Stuck on a God that required her to injure herself to make her worthy of life, worthy of forgiveness and transformation and hope. And I think I was there because for much of my life, I've gotten stuck on God. Stuck on old notions, stuck on all the ways I've let God go, let a certain kind of God go, stuck on asserting what I mean when I say God, asserting so much I've sometimes failed to listen to what others experience as God, or misunderstood their joy or their struggles with their God, asserting so much I fail to experience alongside them that mysterious, transcendent, active source of a love greater than I can even conceive. Failed to respond to this love that is everywhere available and abundant, asking me simply to help spread its reach. Our religious tradition's awkward 10-syllable name, Unitarian Universalist, is one of the few, you might realize, that expresses two explicit claims about the nature of God. Unitarianism affirms the unity of God and rejects Trinitarian orthodoxy in favor of Unitarianism. It was actually originally a pejorative term. They said, "Oh, you're a Unitarian." But ultimately, as with other things like that, we came to embrace it. God is one. Unitarian. Universalism asserts that a loving God would damn no one to hell. We are universally saved. These origins of our UU identity are perhaps especially ironic given that for a long time, our religious movement has also been stuck on God. For a long time, God has been like a taboo word in many of our congregations. And over time, it's like we kind of all learned to self-identify our theological leanings as a way of determining if we were truly among like-minded individuals. despite our lifting up of that saying attributed to 16th century Unitarian Francis David, that we need not think alike to love alike. Are you a theist or an atheist? A Christian or a humanist? Buddhist or pagan? Mystic or activist? Pick, 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 define, define, define. This strict theological labeling spread as folks who attended our churches started to think of themselves as Unitarian Universalist hybrid with something else. Atheist, you, Christian, you, Buddhist, you, etc., etc., etc. Although when it came down to it, it was often light on the you, heavy on the other thing, right? Unitarian Universalism was as if an empty vessel through which we could practice these other things that actually meant something, actually held content of meaning and purpose. As Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams warned against, as these various categories hardened, life began to seep out of them and so out of us and our religious communities. There are many reasons we embraced this hardening of the categories. Among them, we weren't sure how to define ourselves as a singular body after the consolidation of the Unitarians and the Universalists in 1961. And so we needed to anchor ourselves in identities that were already defined. Also, we were nervous that speaking about God would reveal only our differences and break our fragile bond. We lacked faith in and as well as understanding of our covenantal way. We need not think alike to love alike. And we had an influx of folks from other religious traditions who, like the woman I spoke with in the prison, had been taught a constricted concept of God that had left them injured and reactive, defended. And so in a well-intended spirit of compassion, our congregation ceded to their request that no mention of God be made, else it trigger those past experiences. And then the confluence of the religious right with the political right and the concept of the moral majority in the 80s convinced us that our only available path was to claim ourselves in reaction to both of these and posture ourselves somehow as an anti-religion religion. I mean, I suppose when prayer and God looked like they did then, and like we saw in the New Orleans story I shared, when it looks like that, and that's what we think it is, distancing ourselves entirely must have felt like the best possible option. But something interesting has been happening in Unitarian Universalist churches in these past 10 or 15 years, or at least in the faith communities that I interact with in the West. A tide is turning. And it has nothing to do with whether or not we figured out how to use technology in worship. Mostly we haven't. Or whether or not we have great websites. Or whether or not we're reaching out beyond our church buildings. Not so much. The turning is deeper and more substantive than all of those. It is the kind of turning that actually bears the hope of our survival and our continuing relevance in this ever-changing world. The turning is about God. Now, I want to lift up two stories that illustrate this turn. There are surely a host of others, but these are the two that stand out for me. The first was in my preaching class at my Liberal Methodist Seminary, the ILF School of Theology in Denver. The professor of homiletics was fabulous, but also known for being relentlessly puzzled by us Unitarian Universalists. In my preaching course, there were four of us, UU's ministers-to-be, all at different stages of our education and formation. So in the second or third class, one of the others ended up in a dialogue with the professor that ultimately resulted in her asking for that theological concretism we've been trading in for the past 40-ish or so years. She said to my friend, "Wait, what are you? I mean, Christian, humanist, Buddhist, what? What are you?" And my friend paused, looking confused, and she said, "I'm a Unitarian Universalist." "Oh, yeah, my teacher responded, "but what kind of you are you?" I'm a Unitarian Universalist. The teacher was really confused now, and she went around and asked us all to self-identify, and without fail, we all said, I'm a Unitarian Universalist. She was totally shocked. And I hope it led her to go learn, as it was clear we all had, what it meant to be a Unitarian Universalist without qualifiers attached. And to imagine that Unitarian Universalist could be an identity with sufficient meaning and content all on its own. The second was at General Assembly in Salt Lake City in 2009, when the Reverend Galen Gingrich, senior minister at All Souls in New York City, taught a two-day workshop with each day about 6 hours long on UU theology, and about 400 people attended. It was crazy, everyone was stunned. After the first day, most predicted they'd lose about half the attendees, but in fact, more people showed up, and the room was bursting with energy and enthusiasm. All this to hear what was basically a workshop on concepts of God. And it wasn't like build your own theology. It was, here's Unitarian Universalist worship integrated with a constructive theology. Here are our hymns put alongside big theological questions. It wasn't individual focused. It was a gift offered to us all, an invitation to the we of Unitarian Universalism, and a theology that we all could express for today. Now, it didn't assume that everyone agreed with every little detail, but it was willing to make some concrete and particular claims that most Unitarian Universalists found compelling and helpful. The fall after I returned from that General Assembly, I was interning at the UU Church of Boulder, where one of my members had been one of those 400. And though he had long self-identified as an atheist, he was on fire. He proposed that we work together to create a class based on the workshop and offer it to members at UUCB. As soon as we advertised we were doing it, we had 20 people enroll. And over those 8 weeks of our course, we never had fewer than 15 in attendance. And always, they'd all show up having read all the articles, ready to talk and wonder and construct theology together. Now, since then, Galen has taken much of what he offered in his workshop, along with a variety of other sermons and articles, and turned the whole thing into a book that he published last year, God Revised. As with his workshop, the book has Galen tackling a series of common theological questions. He begins with epistemology, how it is that we know what we know. Generally, he affirms human experience as the primary test for truth and upholds logic, reason, and rationality as critical tools. Still, he leaves room for mystery, acknowledging, quote, the most important realities are often the hardest to see. From there, he addresses the nature of existence and the way of describing everything, like everything. Which leads directly to his concept of God, which Dick's reading summarized pretty well. God to him is not supernatural, but a way of speaking about that everything. It is a way to name our experience of being interdependent, located in time and place, but aware of all the many other times and places of the past, present, and future. His theology of God calls to mind something Unitarian Burdette Backer, one of the signers of the 1931 Humanist Manifesto, said about her concept of God. Quote, we are the children of a creative and dynamic universe, and its restless energy is at work within us to carry forward the work of creation. This is what I mean, she says, when I say I believe in God. God is not an idea. God is work to be done in the world. Galen also deals with the nature of humanity as well as the role of religion and the nature of faith. He asks if we need to be saved, if so, from what, by what. He addresses our mission and purpose in the world and proposes an ethical paradigm he calls an ethic of gratitude. And finally, he makes a proposal for how all of this can and should be lived out within Unitarian Universalism and our Unitarian Universalist congregations. Now, there's a lot about God Revised and Galen's work that doesn't resonate for me. I find its insistence on the Enlightenment as an anchoring paradigm to be kind of problematic and actually outdated for a multicultural, post-colonial, and post-modern world. And I find its division between what he calls traditional religion and the concepts that he identifies as evolved to be somewhat condescending and not even all that accurate. The book A House for Hope by John Burens and Rebecca Parker, also a recent Unitarian Universalist comprehensive theology, offers an account that I find more compatible with postmodern feminist, womanist, mujerista, and queer theologies. You can find that one in our bookstore as well, or for your e-reader on Amazon.com. And still, I remain profoundly grateful to Galen and what he's been up to in his ministry over the past decade. And I recommend his book to all of you. His writing pulls us out of that theist, atheist polarity desert we've been wandering in these last 40 or 50 years. He offers a way to say both are right. And he does this grounded in a specific theology that makes particular claims. His willingness to speak boldly and straightforwardly in turn reveals and inspires our collective hunger and capacity to do this kind of bold and straightforward theology together and more regularly as Unitarian Universalists. On that day in the prison, what now feels like a lifetime ago, the woman held out her arms covered in scars, and my heart broke for her. The God that she had been taught to believe in couldn't take the anger inside her, couldn't take her shame or her pain. It would be too overwhelming, too frightening, or offensive to her flimsy God. And so as our stories came together that day, she and I started to revise these ideas she had for God, to let God grow, let God be bigger, big enough to take it all the messiness, the anger, all the fight we could throw. I kept encouraging her, God can take it. Just yell and scream and ask God why. I think she was terrified. But still, for those few moments, I felt our breathing slow, and there was a tangible feeling of love and hope between us, all made possible through our shared construction of an image of God beyond that which would offer salvation by way of self-injury. God. God is a word. It's a word that we use to try to describe the feeling we have of being small and big, on our own, yet somehow profoundly connected to everything else. It's our shorthand to describe our sense of an ultimate reality. Where we run into trouble is when we confuse the naming of the experience with the experience itself and imagine that somehow the conclusions and interpretations that we've made or that someone else has made are primary, and then lock up those conclusions set in stone and force our lived experiences to somehow comply. I began this month speaking on idolatry, and that's just what this kind of confusion is, treating the interpretation as if it's the thing itself. But all theology is an attempt to describe the indescribable, name the unnameable, which means in many ways all theological utterances are a lie. And as the Upanishads attest, quote, those who think that God is not comprehended, by them God is comprehended. But those who think that God is comprehended know God not. Still, as meaning makers, humans must attempt to bring to speech some concept of life in its widest possible sense, to acknowledge our experience of the mysterious reality within which we all live. We are compelled to interpret, to try to understand, compelled to attempt to name and claim the story we're in and our role in it. We are all natural theologians. We can't help it. Now, God Revised, as you heard in the reading, advocates strongly for integrating into our interpretations a concept of God and the use of God language. Personally, I'm not sure it really matters. As James Luther Adams also offers, the spirit of life can be interpreted theistically or atheistically. What does matter is that we continue to loosen our categories, let more breathing room in, let ourselves explore and not get stuck on God or any of it. What is critical is that we experiment with holy curiosity and let down our defenses so we can better hear one another, be with one another, recover from our individual and collective religious injuries of the past, and move together into a free and creative, liberated and liberating constructive theology. One, I am confident, will be the lifeblood of our living, breathing, Unitarian Universalist faith. May it be so. Amen. Now,